Okay, well, do you think the funding funding environment and the kind of reward system that's set up in the peer review of publications and of grants, what role does that play in the kinds of, in shaping the kinds of scientific research programs that are developed? For instance, does the American system tend to fund the same kind of science, or that, you do what you need to do to stay afloat, I think is what the term you used yesterday, and you publish papers even though they may not be groundbreaking, and that, long-term projects by necessity are riskier projects. So, I guess another way of looking at this, and maybe that's the question I'm going to ask, is are there such things as national styles of science, and does the American system select for...
No, I don't think so. For funding in the national level, you've got to have some criteria to give people funding.
Okay.
If somebody does not produce anything in 5-10 years,
mm-hmm.
how can a reviewer decide whether this person is doing something really difficult and it's just hard, we should keep funding this person? Or this person is just doing something really stupid. That approach is never going to work. So I think I just believe this is the only way. It's up to the wits of the researchers to figure out how they're going to make their career. They either take a higher risk or lower risk, or do, push different directions. I think this funding is fine, but I think it is important to have private foundations to fund more risky projects, because there, I think those candidates were mostly chosen by the person, not the project. Like Hughes always say, they fund the person, they don't fund the project. I think that's more or less what Pew does as well.
Yeah,
they are not funding the project. They are mostly looking at the person, what they have done. Are they most likely to be creative and to do something original than others? If yes, we take them. But for the national level, and that was the bread and butter of the science, I think you can't take that approach. You have to take an approach where you allow a diverse group of people to take their own ingenuity, to design their own way of approaching a problem. It can be sometimes mundane, but you need those mundane incremental knowledge as well. So I think it has to take a combination. I think National Institute of Health funding is fine. I think they're doing the right thing. Otherwise, how can you determine? You can't determine. And also, you can't really downplay the incremental progress. Sometimes incremental progress, many of those add to a big progress. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, do you have any teaching responsibilities here?
Very little.
Yeah. Okay.
I probably will be. It depends. I mean, this is one thing, like a great advantage I have, and also a great source of my own feeling of being sufficient, because I feel like I have all these advantages. If I can do something that's really great, I would feel very ashamed.
Okay.
I don't have to teach much, very little.
Yeah.
If I think it's possible I can get involved in to teaching more graduate courses, but so far I've been only teaching one, and that's every other year, and that's just 3 period of lecturing, and the rest of the time just hear students talk. So it's very lame.
Well, obviously you came directly to the Carnegie, so you didn't have much teaching experience before that, but what would you say is the advantages and disadvantages to not having any teaching responsibilities?
to not having any teaching teaching responsibilities, you would not be a very, I think your talk, your own seminar talk, probably wouldn't be as good as if you actually also have to teach undergrads and graduate students. Because that really, teaching undergrads and graduate students allow you to look at your problem from far away and thinking at the much lower level to really allow people, lead people into your field. I've seen people giving talks. I've seen people who taught undergrads really give great talks. You get it. It's just so easy going, easy coming out. No matter how deep, how complicated they lead you through, you feel it's so, has so much clarity. I think I would really benefit by having to teach undergrads. And it disadvantages time.
Yeah.
And you really have to be extremely well organized, and I'm terribly disorganized. So I think I would be in more of a stress if I have to teach undergrads and graduate students, because I just don't have a very strong organizational skill. People who have a strong organization skill probably will be surviving better than people who don't.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, we've talked briefly on and off about kind of your pressures from your personal life and your professional life, if you want to choose to divide it up that way. But I'd like to talk a little bit more, and just to get the chronology down, you met your husband in graduate school,
yeah.
And when did you have your child?
I had him at the end of my third year in graduate school.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's when I know I'm going to have a paper.
Okay.
I know I can graduate.
Oh, okay. Was that factored into the decision to have a child?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I would never have had a child if I didn't know I would get a paper.
Okay.
Because it's just impossible.
Because the paper meant?
Paper meant you are likely to graduate.
Wait, okay.
So then you can say, okay, now let's put this extra burden in, and I can probably still stay afloat.
Yeah.
I still think graduate school is the best time to have a baby.
Yeah.
And my student is having a baby.
Okay.
I told her it's the best time if you want to have a career. No matter what career you want to get in, I think it's best to have a kid when you are young, where even though you are not necessarily having a whole lot of money, but you have so much energy.
Okay.
You're not tired. I worked nonstop. I get to probably about 6 hours sleep. I never really felt that tired.
Yeah.
It was just nothing. Now, I don't think I can do it. I mean, after I started my job, I don't think I could do it.
Yeah. Okay, and what about the postdoc years?
I think it's very hard.
Okay.
Because when you're a graduate student, your concern is to graduate, right? That's so if you learn techniques, you graduate, you're okay. It's not you have to develop something profound. Well, you're a postdoc. You really need to develop something profound. You need to work independently. You need to read a lot, think a lot. You need to, your immediate future is to look for a job. Graduate student, no. That's why I think graduate student is the best time. I think postdoc is the worst time. Being a faculty is better than postdoc, because after being a faculty, you make a little bit more money.
Okay.
Then you can really arrange things better. Postdoc don't make as much money as PIs.
Okay. And you have one child?
I have only one, and that has something to do with that, you know, I have a career, my husband had a career.
Yeah.
Okay. And we were both very busy, and his job situation was not settled for many, many years. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you had mentioned briefly in the first session that he, chose to put his career second to yours and the decision to accept the position at Carnegie and go on the job market. And how has that worked out for him now after finishing his
postdoc? I think he's happy now. Whereas he wasn't happy for many years. He felt maybe he had made a mistake to come here, to leave Mike Bishop's lab. But now he's pretty happy, because after his effort, he put in a lot of effort, he finally managed to get a job at Hopkins.
Oh, okay.
And he was a faculty at Hopkins School of Medicine for 2 years, and it's his decision that that's not for him.
Oh.
After 2 years.
Okay.
He at least get to his goal. He got to his goal. he got an idea about what it is to run your lab, to do research, and he decided that's not really for him. And he decided to go to NIH to be a program director.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So he's still in the field.
He's still in science, but he's no longer at the bench. He's not a bench scientist anymore. He's not running his lab.
So his work day involves a commute?
Well, yeah. So in the first year we moved here, he said Hopkins, he didn't have to commute. But the next 3 years he was at NCI.
Okay.
He was with Ed Liu, where he learned how to do microarray. Those are early days of microarray. He learned that technique. So he commuted for 3 years, and then he came back for 2 years at Hopkins. Now, that he didn't commute, and now he started to commute for a whole year already. So he's have to commute now. But it's much easier of a commute because his job as a grant administrator is really regular hours.
Okay. Yeah.
So that makes it bearable, tolerable to commute.
Yeah. Okay. And how, when he was going through, you know, trying to figure out what he really wanted to do, what impact did that have on your future here at Carnegie?
Well, he never let anything to affect my career.
Okay.
He's just a very selfless person. He never wanted to have his problem affect my career in any way. So I think the only thing that made me feel, the only thing that sort of affected me is I felt guilty all the time. Mm-hmm. I felt terrible all the time. I felt because of my being not very flexible, because the one option he wanted to consider is that he will stay at UCSF and he will take care of our son and I will come here first and he'll spend a year or two maybe hoping to find a job here. I just didn't like that option because I don't want to be separated with my child, and I don't think he would really make much progress if he end up having to take care of our son by himself.
Yeah.
I think it's easier if you have two to mm-hmm. take care of one child. So I didn't like that idea. I said, if you want to do that, I will take the staff associate or UCSF fellow position. And he said, so that's a definitely no-no for me. So in the end, he came. So I've always felt very guilty about that.
Yeah. And how well have you been able to divide child care and household chores?
It's really equal. He's been a great husband. I think a lot of families, I mean, I used to have this illusion that American culture where, you know, husband and wives are really equal. But I actually, after being here for many years, I see actually women still tend to do more work at home, and there's still this unequalness mm-hmm. in families. And I think, you know, in China, among Chinese families, this is probably even more so. But my husband is just really great.
Yeah. Okay.
He always did his share, sometimes more than his share when I get busy.
Yeah, okay. And how well do you balance your roles as scientist, mother, and wife?
Definitely sacrificed my role as a wife.
Okay.
But I don't think I sacrificed my role as a mom.
Okay.
At least I tried my best.
Yeah.
So the way, I mean, maybe I'm just saying it to, thinking this way to make me feel more comfortable,
mm-hmm.
to feel good about things. Mm-hmm. It would be good to see how my son felt when he grew up. But the way I felt is, you know, yeah, being a good mom doesn't mean that you just sit home with your son. That's good enough, being a good mom. I think being a good mom is really to just get your son to be exposed to interesting things in life, interesting people in life. I think my son had always been exposed to my colleagues because I always bring him to the lab. He grew up in the lab, and he always got a lot of attention every time he comes to the lab. Not here, I mean, when mm-hmm. I was a postdoc. He would be drawing, he'd be talking to people. This is the other thing I really felt very grateful about the group I was with. They loved him. He would just have everybody to talk to, and everybody loved his drawing, and they would ask for his drawing. He loved drawing. He's a very good artist. he'll be drawing there. I'll throw him a pile of pencil or pen, and he'll be drawing. Sometimes he'll draw on the board in our area. We're all completely open. Several labs are all together. The lunch area is open. So I think he had an interesting time. And also I take him to meetings. You know, sometimes it's boring. He had to wait out while I'm in the meeting. He just happens to be a child that's very easy to deal with. He throw him a book, throw him a pile of pencil paper. He's happy. Mm-hmm. And that makes life easier for me as well. So I don't know. I think I balanced out in certain ways that I think, looking at him now, I think he's fine. I think he's probably among his peers, he's traveled a lot more than most kids, because I take him to all the meetings I go to.
Yeah.
Whenever possible, I take him with me, and then I would take 2 or 3 days. We'll tour a little bit.
So is he going to pursue his career in science?
He enjoys science, and sometimes I would just show him simple phenomena.
Yeah. And what if he came to you and said, I want to be a novelist?
It would be okay.
Yeah. Okay.
I think he's a very level-headed person. He's not like me.
Okay.
He really is much more level-headed, much easier to deal with. He's in piano. I mean, this is the other investment I did. Even though I have been very busy, I've always taken him. So he's been having very serious piano training at Peabody.
He's been doing
that for 7 years, as long as I've been here. So every week he has 2 lessons, one private, one group. Group is theory, private is, skills, playing. I always have been the one doing that. And also since the program he's in requires parental input, I've always sat down and practiced with him. Every day, 1 hour for 5 years. And after that, he grew older, he's more rebellious. I quit. I don't sit with him because he would be unhappy. Mm. But before that, I sat down. I was also very tough. He had to practice.
Yeah.
I was really tough.
Yeah.
So I think you can manage. Depends on how you define a good mother. If you define a good mother of attending to every single details of your child, then I'm not a good mom. But if you define a good mom of affording your child to do things that will really have a long-term impact on your child, I think I'm a reasonable mom.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I definitely have not spent enough time compared with 8-hour mom, 8-hour job mom. There's no time I can ever claim that, but whenever I'm not with him, my husband is with him. So we have not been spending much time with each other, but we always made sure that somebody is spending time with him.
Yeah.
So I think it's possible to manage if you have a very strong, solid relationship with your spouse, and you don't really have to be together to really keep that going. It would work.
And when he brings home B pluses and A minuses in math and English, how do you react?
We are really a lot more relaxed than my parents.
Okay.
My husband had always felt, well, math, you can learn that later. He always felt like piano or art is something you really want to instill into your kid. And my son happens to be very artsy. He's a very good artist. He really draws well. But we haven't really done much in terms of training him in drawing. He's very natural. But piano is something we really paid a lot of attention. We really made sure he put time in there. Because those are the skills. If you don't develop early, it's going to be very hard to do that later.
Yeah.
Those kind of, because your brain, it's not as plastic
when
you grow older.
Yeah.
So, what's your question? I'm sorry.
That's okay. Just if you got on his case about bringing home B pluses and A minuses.
Oh yeah.
Today.
No, so I think he sometimes get B minus. A B, he probably. I don't think he ever got B minus. But, well, okay. He went to a school. That's another thing that was kind of interesting. After he came here. When we were deciding where to send him to school, we made a decision, conscious decision, of that since we're Chinese, we're very restrictive in terms of training, less creative in terms of training. So we want him to go to an environment where creativity, imagination is encouraged greatly, and not really mundane kind of a spoon-fed type of training. So we sent him to Mark School, which is the independent school, which claims that they have progressive education. They really encourage kids the interest in learning, not really knowledge. Mm-hmm. So he went there. I think there's some consequences. I don't think that school is as rigorous in terms of drilling students for basic principles, ideas, and basic math or basic things.
Mm-hmm.
So his standardized test, I think his math, I would say, is probably A minus, sometimes B plus. And we know why, because he just didn't have enough time to practice on it, and we never paid attention. Sometimes I worry if we have made the right choice, but in the end we decided, well, no, we will keep him there because he made his friends. He feel very comfortable there for his type of personality. So my husband now started to sort of help him with, give him more basic training in math. That's how we are doing it. We're not really trying to give him much pressure. I never check his homework. He's very good. He always does his homework. And they don't have exam. That school does not have exam until high school.
Okay.
So there's no way for us even to know how well he's doing other than the standardized test that if we want to know. Well, they send back once every year.
Yeah. Is it now this is a private school?
Yeah, it's a private school.
And then where will he go for high school?
It's all through.
Through, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's in a very beautiful suburban setting. It's really nice.
Yeah.
It's rural setting. Yeah, suburban setting. Yeah, it's surrounded by mountains and woods.
Yeah.
It's very nice. I wanted to go to school there.
Okay, well, on a little bit different topic, or maybe it's actually parallels it, is what's the gender makeup in your lab? How many men?
I don't think that really has much bearing in terms of, what my choice is. I have no choice. Anybody comes that is reasonable come. It's very interesting. In the beginning, my lab is mostly women. Well, actually, I had all women for 2 years.
Really?
Until a boy showed up. And then he got teased all the time. They were just making fun of it.
Right. And what do you think accounts for why you attracted women?
I think that probably is because I was a woman. I think I tend to get women scientists consider me. I think it has something to do with it. Now it's less obvious. I mean, I have probably half and half.
Yeah.
Yeah, about half and half.
Yeah. Okay. And when you had this discussion with one of your students about when's the best time to have a child, was that a male or a female?
It's a female.
Yeah. And do you ever get males asking
you
about
this? Well, I just had one case where they are considering of starting a family.
Yeah. Okay.
All my students have been female.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. Okay.
And the other two were married, so.
Well, how much do you think that, what difference do you think it makes on the kinds of research projects that you do? Are women and men attracted to different kinds of projects?
I don't think so. Not in biology. I think biology, I don't know. I mean, it looks to me maybe guys are more attracted to math and physics, but biology, I think people tend to do similar things in biology.
Yeah.
Maybe in evolutionary biology there is some gender bias. I don't know.
Yeah. And what difference does it make in how you train a student to if they're male or female? And I guess, do women and men learn science differently?
I can't tell because I haven't had a male student. Graduate student.
Yeah.
I can't tell. Maybe they are more stubborn. I don't know.
Well, there's been a lot of reports done in science, and particularly since the MIT study, that shows at the graduate level it's about 50-50, and at the postdoc it becomes slightly skewed. But by the time you look at the senior, tenured members of faculty, it's primarily males.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think accounts for
this? I think what's really accounts for that is that once you have a child, it takes a lot of effort to keep going. It takes a lot of support from your spouse to keep going. Your spouse not only really have to be supportive at home to share the load, but also have to be supportive in encouraging you to say, well, don't worry, we're doing fine. I want you to have a good career. I think you're doing great. I'm proud of you. I think that's what it takes. If my husband is not encouraging me all these years, I would have quit at any point of my career. Is there times I feel like, why am I have to work so hard? And, you know, yet also very frustrated, you know, when something doesn't work and when things are just not going as well as you wanted. And then I don't spend enough time with my husband and my child. You need encouragement. I think women, I don't know American women, as Chinese women, even though I come from a family where my parents really expect a lot of me, the culture has been that you don't have to have a career. Who said you have to have a career? Boys have more sort of being instilled very early on, they need to have a career. I don't know if that's the case in this country. Maybe that's even so in this country. So for women to survive, to really keep going, you really have to have the right kind of environment.
Yeah.
Unless you are just an extraordinary woman who does not need any encouragement, who's just superwoman, who can work like 16 hours a day without feeling very tired. And, you know, there must be those kind of women who survived in those old dark ages,
yeah,
become famous. I don't know.
So does science select for a certain personality type or a certain personal life choices?
Probably, because for women, you just really have to choose certain things and give up certain things if you want to have a career. I don't even think it's science, it's any career.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to choose what's more important, what's less important. And science probably selects the type of women who are less, I would say, who are less bothered by not being the ideal mother. I don't know. Being the ideal wife. I don't know.
Well, since we, at least at this point in time, we can't change kind of biological roles that women have to have, bear the children and men don't. Is this structure of science that we have that, you know, it's okay to be a graduate student, but it's going to be more difficult to become a tenure for a woman. Is this something that's static? And what impact does it have on science if, you know, there's more graduate students that are women, but there's very few senior members of science that are women?
Well, it's been going on like this for many, many years,
right,
and science is still moving forward. I don't think it'd be having some profound impact from the science perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But sociologically, I think it's just going to keep putting women in this role of, like, always when there is time to make a career decision, you put your family life ahead of your career.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in many cases it's a personal choice, but those personal choices based upon society influence as women grew up from a girl. I think if you feel you're always going to be taking a lesser role compared to your husband in the family in terms of career, but more role of homemaking, if you already was instilled like that, that will be what you decide to do.
Yeah.
When it comes to the time that you have to make certain sacrifices, you would most likely sacrifice your career. But I don't really think it's going to impact the society, the progress of science as a whole.
Okay, well, how important is it to have women scientists at all?
Well, I think I don't think it's how important it is to have women scientists. It's how important to have good scientists.
Okay.
I think that's important. And I think, you know, by and large, we have such a huge population of scientists. I mean, I could be criticized as a woman saying this. It could be bad, but I just don't feel that's a science issue. I more feel it's a sociological issue.
Okay.
It's a social science issue, not a science and technology issue. I think we're built in such a way. I mean, so far I don't see how women doing biology would be substantially different from men doing biology. There is no data saying women would contribute in biology in a fundamentally different way that's fundamentally important. There's no data on that. That's why I'm not convinced this is an issue about how important it is to biological research. It's more how important it is for women's quality of life, for women's satisfaction of their life.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, and then the other issue would be what's the ethnic makeup of your lab?
Oh, yeah. In the beginning, it's essentially one country, one person from a country. It's my graduate student. One is from Peru. The other is from Sri Lanka.
Uh-huh.
My postdoc, one is from England. Mm-hmm. The other is from Germany.
Wow.
So that's my first, my technician. One is from China. The other one is from America. So it's one from each country. Now I have a student from China, mostly Asian now. It's not by choice. It's just there's just not many people up there. Europeans tend to go to New York, Bay Area.
Okay.
Asian is a big pool that you can still recruit. So now I have one from Taiwan, two from Japan, one from Hong Kong. That's my postdoc.
Yeah.
And I have one technician from China, one student from China. That's
okay.
The makeup.
So you're pretty much a multinational lab.
Yeah, it's been very multinational.
And how does that kind of reflect, do you think, in your other experiences, in your other labs and labs that you know about?
In my graduate lab, it was pretty multinational.
Okay.
My fellow graduate student is from Korea, and then later Burl had one student from Lebanon. The other one is American. And the rest are American, but just the rest is just a postdoc. And my boss's wife is from England.
So okay. Yeah.
And then Bruce's lab is a little bit more homogeneous.
Okay.
More. So there was one European, two European, and me from China. The rest are American.
Oh, that's interesting. And why? What do you think accounts for that? Because I would assume he would have more people in his
life. I think it's just competition.
Okay.
So Bruce has a very big name. He has a very good lab. UCSF is a great training place.
Yeah.
So the good Americans, basically, if you go, I don't know if you paid attention to this. If you go to universities, the best universities you go, you still see predominantly Americans. And then you go down a tier, you start to see some Europeans. And then you go down further, you start to see some Asian.
Okay, and what accounts for this hierarchy?
What accounts for that hierarchy? It's very natural, because in Asia, really, the best biology training is still from Japan. Japan is a tiny country. And China is going to become really good, but It's been so many years China's biological research is just lagging behind.
Yeah.
So of course they can't produce nearly as many high quality people. But I think my bet is that it's going to take over. China is going to take over Japan in terms of producing really good high quality researchers in probably 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
So I think that's the reason. And also there is language barrier. You know, if I have a choice of equally good candidates, I would choose somebody who can speak English very well, communicate very well, instead of somebody who really have difficulty in communication. It's just only natural. I don't think there's any prejudice. It's all merit-based. I believe all scientists who run labs, they take one approach, merit-based. They would never do anything different because it's only detrimental to their own progress, to their own mere survival. You have to do it in a merit-based way.
Well, then I may be begging an answer here, but how important is it to maintain cultural diversity in a lab?
I don't think it's that important. Again, I think it's more important to maintain a highly active research group, maintain high quality, than diversity. That's not definitely not on my agenda. I'm not up to maintain diversity. But I would love to be able to maintain a group where communication is highly available. I mean, people talk to each other and there is no communication barrier. So if I had a choice, I would love to recruit the highest, the best quality people who can communicate in English fluently. And that's definitely not what I have. But I don't have a choice.
Well, I want to backtrack a little bit. I did want to ask if your son is bilingual.
He is, but his Chinese is not as good as I would like to have. He can understand.
Can he write?
He cannot write. No.
No, okay.
He can't read very well either.
Yeah.
I would like him to be bilingual, but it's among all the things I want him to do, I decided maybe we can take cuts in Chinese and so he can do more time on piano.
Yeah,
it's again a choice.
Right.
Maybe it's a wrong choice, but he enjoys it.
Has he spent much time with his grandparents in China?
Well, actually, his grandma is living with us. He's my mother-in-law.
Okay.
With us
okay.
for the past 3 years.
Oh, okay.
But it's just he doesn't have the time.
He
has to practice piano. His old work.
Right.
Various activities.
He has to. And your sister is now living in
D.C.
In D.C. And what about your parents?
They're in Dayton, Ohio.
Okay, so
my father, like I said, he came, he was able to, because he's really very good. He's the best in his field. It's a narrow field of gear engineering, but he's the best, there's no doubt. That's why he was able to get a job in his late 50s with broken English.
Yeah, and is he in academics or is
no,
he
he's
in
the company. He's managing their gear. He was there for 10 years helping them out. And he retired now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about science has done a couple of articles since the Wenho Lee case and or the Los Alamos case. And that Asian Americans have felt kind of a growing antagonism towards Asian faces in science, and a lot of this was focused in labs that did defense research. But it's also brought together kind of a new consciousness about Asian stereotypes, personality stereotypes, and their ability to move beyond just being assistant researchers and into administrative posts. That there's something.
I think it's definitely still there.
Okay, and I just wanted to how much do you think how accurate is this kind of stereotype of the Asian personality of being kind of self-effacing and low-key and maybe less competitive or less aggressive in a competitive lab environment?
Okay. I think the first part is right. I think that's actually reflecting more of Asian culture, just low-key and sort of attending, making sure you do your own things well.
Yeah.
Don't bother about other people, what they are doing.
Yeah.
Just taking care of your own business, be a good citizen. That's very much of an Asian traditional value we were taught for generations.
Right.
It's kind of hard to change. But I don't necessarily agree that Asians are less competitive. I think there's equal kind of competitiveness.
Okay.
It's just the way they approach toward competition is different.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and has there been a price to be paid for that? Using your own career as an example, would you say you have faced some kind of discrimination because of these stereotypes?
I don't think this stereotype has affected my type of career. But I have a feeling if people like me one day decided, you know what, I want to develop my skill in administration, I want to become a dean, I want to become a president of a university, I think then you will start to feel that.
Yeah.
I think at this stage of career, I don't see that. I think it's a very, very good culture, and it just doesn't.
Yeah. Well, with your own students and postdocs, how aware are you when you see somebody fitting this stereotype, whether it's male or female, how aware are you conscious of you that...
You can't really change that. I mean, okay. I think it, to a large extent, depend on the personality. I mean, I'm Asian. I have all these traditional values, but I happen to be somebody very outgoing. I think everywhere I went, I was told, you're not behaving like a Chinese. So I like to talk. I like to yap. Anybody can make a conversation with me. I don't hide anything. I'm very straightforward. I just say whatever I think. And that was hard for me in China, but it was great here. I love it here. So it's a personality issue as well. So one thing I think as a PI you could do, as an advisor you could do, is to encourage that. But I don't think you can really ever change it. It also comes with whether a particular person is good with their communication skills as well. So I think it's a combination of the cultural value and the communication skill that made this kind of outlook of Asian in general that created this stereotype.
Yeah.
Okay. I think you can only guide people to say, well, you need to ask more questions, you need to be more interactive, you need to go out and talk to people more, discuss things more. But it may not really, in the end, have a profound change on a person.
Yeah.
That's how I feel.
Yeah. Okay. Let me pop in a new tape.